As they came aboard, they saluted her respectfully and then barely glanced at her red diplomatic passport. They took a little longer with Peter's blue and gold British passport, and Magda murmured to Peter with a trace of a smile, "I must get you a little red book. It's so much easier." Then to the officials, "It is a cold morning, gentlemen. I hope you'll take a glass." And her white-jacketed steward was hovering already. They left the two Frenchmen removing their kepis and pistol belts, settling down comfortably in the leather armchairs to make a leisurely selection of the cigars and cognac that the steward had produced for their approval. There were three cars waiting for them, parked in the back of a hangar with drivers and guards. Peter's lip curled as he saw the Maserati. "I told you not to drive that thing," he said gruffly. "It's like having your name in neon lights." They had argued about this vehicle while Peter was reorganizing her personal security, for the Maserati was an electric silver grey, one of her favourite colours, a shimmering dart of metal. She swayed against him with that husky little chuckle of hers. "Oh, that is so very nice, to have a man being masterful again. It makes me feel like a woman." "I have other ways of making you feel like that." "I know," she agreed, with a wicked flash of green eyes, "and I like those even better, but not now, please. What in the world would my staff think?" Then seriously, "You take the Maserati. I ordered it for you anyway. Somebody may as well enjoy it. And please, do not be late this evening. I have especially made it free for us. Try and be at La Pia Benite by 8 o'clock, will you, please?" By the time Peter had to slow for the traffic along the Pont Noelli entrance to Paris, he had accustomed himself to the surging power and acceleration of the Maserati, and, as she had suggested, he was enjoying himself. Even in the mad Parisian traffic, he used the slick gearbox to knife through the merest suspicion of an opening, bulling out of trouble or overtaking with the omnipotent sense of power that control of the magnificent machine bestowed upon its driver. He knew then why Magda loved it so dearly, and when he parked it at last in the underground garage on the Champs-Élysées side of Concorde, he grinned at himself in the mirror. "Bloody cowboy," he said, and glanced at his Rolex. He had an hour before his first appointment, and as a sudden thought, unclipped the holster of the Cobra, and with a pistol still in it, locked it in the glove compartment of the Maserati. He grinned again as he pondered the inadvisability of marching into French naval headquarters armed to the teeth. The drizzle had cleared, and the chestnut trees in the Élysée Gardens were popping their first green buds as he came out into Concorde. He used one of the call boxes in the Concorde metro station to make a call to the British Embassy. He spoke to the British military attaché for 2 minutes, and when he hung up, he knew the ball was probably already in play. If Caliph had penetrated the Atlas Command deeply enough to know him personally as the commander of Thor, then it would not be too long before he knew that the former commander had picked up the spoor. The military attaché at the Paris embassy had other, more clandestine duties than kissing the ladies' hands at diplomatic cocktail parties. Peter reached the main gates of the Marine headquarters on the corner of the Rue Royale with a few minutes to spare. But already there was a secretary waiting for him below the billowing tricolour. He smoothed Peter's way past the sentries and led him to the armaments committee room on the third floor, overlooking a misty grey view of the Seine and the gilded arches of the Pont Neuf. Two of Peter's assistants from Namco were there ahead of him, with their briefcases unpacked and the contents spread upon the polished walnut table. The French flag captain had been in Brussels, and on one unforgettable evening he had conducted Peter on a magic carpet tour of the brothels of that city. He greeted him now with cries of Gallic pleasure and addressed him as tu and toi, which all boded very well for the meeting ahead. At noon precisely, the French captain moved that the meeting adjourn across the street to a private room on the first floor of Maxime's, blissful in the certainty that Namco would pick up the tab, if they were really serious about selling the Kestrel rocket motors to the French Navy. It required all Peter's tact not to make it obvious that he was taking less than his share of the Clos de Vougeot or of the Remy Martin. and more than once he found that he had missed part of the discussion, which was being conducted at a steadily increasing volume. He found that he was thinking of emerald eyes and small pert bosoms. From Maxime's back to the Ministry of Marine, and later it required another major act of diplomacy on Peter's part, when the captain smoothed his moustache and cocked a knowing eye at Peter. There is a charming little club very close and wonderfully friendly. By 6 o'clock, Peter had disentangled himself from the Frenchman's company, with protestations of friendship and promises to meet again in 10 days' time. An hour later, Peter left his two sales assistants at the Hotel Maurice after a quick but thorough summation of the day's achievements. They were, all three, agreed that it was a beginning, but a long, long road lay ahead to the ending. He walked back along Rivoli. Despite the frowsiness of a long day of endless talk and the necessity for quick thinking in a language which was still strange on the tongue, despite a slight ache behind the eyes from the wine and cognac, and despite the taste of cigar and cigarette smoke he had breathed, he was buoyed by a tingling sense of anticipation. For Magda was waiting, and he stepped out briskly. As he paused for traffic lights, he caught a glimpse of his own reflection in a shop window. He was smiling without realizing it. While he waited on the ramp of the parking garage for his turn to pay and enter the traffic stream, with a Maserati engine whispering impatiently, he glanced in the rear-view mirror. He had acquired the habit long ago, when one of the captured Provo death lists had begun with his name. Since then, he had learned to look over his shoulder. He noticed the Citroën 2 back in the line of vehicles, because the windshield was cracked, and there was a scrape which had dented the mudguard and exposed a bright strip of bare metal. He noticed the same black Citroën still 2 back as he waited for pedestrian lights in the Champs-Élysées, and when he ducked his head slightly to try to get a look at the driver, the headlights switched on as though to frustrate him, and at that moment the lights changed and he had to drive on. Going round the Étoile, the Citroën had fallen back 4 places in the grey, drizzling dusk of early autumn. But he spotted it once again when he was halfway down the Avenue de la Grande Armée, for by now he was actively searching for it. This time it changed lanes and slipped off the main thoroughfare to the left. It was immediately lost in the maze of side streets, and Peter should have been able to forget it and concentrate on the pleasure of controlling the Maserati. But there lingered a sense of foreboding, and even after he had shot the complicated junction of roads that got him onto the periphery route, and eventually out onto the road to Versailles and Chartres, he found himself changing lanes and speed while he scanned the road behind in the mirror. Only when he left Versailles and was on the Rambouillet Road did he have a clear view back a mile down the straight avenue of plane trees, and he was certain there was no other vehicle on the road. He relaxed completely and began to prepare himself for the final turn-off that would bring him at last to La Pierre-Bénite. The shiny, wet, black python of road uncoiled ahead of him and then humped abruptly. Peter came over the rise at 150 kilometres an hour and instantly started to dance lightly on the brake and clutch, avoiding the temptation of tramping down hard and losing adhesion on the slippery, uneven tarmac. Ahead of him, there was a gendarme in a shiny white plastic cape, wet with rain, brandishing a torch with a red lens. There were reflective warning triangles, bright as rubies. A Peugeot in the ditch beside the road, with headlights glaring at the sky. A dark blue police combi van, half blocking the road. And in the stage, lit by the combi's headlights, 2 bodies were laid out neatly, and all of it hazed by the soft, insistent mantle of falling rain. A typical roadside accident scene. Peter had the Maserati well in hand, bringing her neatly down through the gears to a crawl. And as he was lowering the side window, the electric motor whining softly and the icy gust of night air into the heated interior, the gendarme gestured with a flashlight for him to pull over into the narrow gap between hedge and the parked combi. And at that moment, the unexpected movement caught Peter's eye. It was one of the bodies lying in the road under the headlights. The movement was the slight arch of the back, that a man makes before rising from the prone position. Peter watched him lift his arm, not more than a few inches. But it was just enough for Peter to realize he had been holding an object concealed down the outside of his thigh. And even in the rain and the night, Peter's trained eye recognized the perforated, air-cooled sleeve enclosing the short barrel of a fold-down machine pistol. Instantly his brain was racing, so that everything about him seemed to be taking place in dreamy, slow motion. The Maserati, he thought, they're after Magda. The gendarme was coming round to the driver's side of the Maserati, and he had his right hand under the white plastic cape, at the level of his pistol belt. Peter went flat on the gas pedal, and the Maserati bellowed like a bull buffalo shot through the heart. The rear wheels broke from the wet surface, and with a light touch, Peter encouraged the huge silver machine to swing like a scythe at the gendarme. It should have cut him down, but he was too quick. As he dived for the hedge, Peter saw that he had brought the pistol out from under his cape, but was too busy at that moment to use it. The side of the Maserati touched the hedge with a fluttering rustle of foliage, and Peter lifted his right foot, caught the enraged charge of the machine, and swung her the other way. The moment she was lined up, he hit the gas again, and the Maserati howled. This time she burned blue rubber smoke off her rear wheels. There was a driver at the wheel of the blue police combi, and he tried to pull across to block the road completely, but he wasn't fast enough. The two vehicles touched with a crackle and scream of metal that jarred Peter's teeth, but what concerned him was that the two bodies and the headlights were no longer flat. The nearest one was on one knee, and he was swinging the short, stubby machine pistol. It looked like a Sterling or the new Sidewinder, but he was using the fold-down wire butt, wasting vital fractions of a second to get the weapon to his shoulder. He was also blocking the field of fire of the man who crouched behind him with another machine pistol pinned to his hip, pointing with index finger and forearm, ready to trigger with his second finger. That's the way it should be done. Peter recognized professional skill, and his brain was running so swiftly that he had time to applaud it. The Maserati cannoned off the police combi, and Peter lifted his right foot to take traction off the rear wheels and spun the wheel, the hard lock to the right. The Maserati swung her tail with a screech of rubber and went into a left-side slide towards the two figures in the road, and Peter ducked down below the level of the door. He had deliberately induced the left-hand slide, so that he had some little protection from the engine compartment and bodywork. As he ducked, he heard the familiar sound, like a giant ripping heavyweight canvas, an automatic weapon throwing bullets at a cyclic rate of almost 2,000 rounds a minute. And the bullets tore into the side of the Maserati, beating in the metal with an ear-numbing clangor, while glass exploded in upon Peter like the glittering spray as a storm-driven wave strikes a rock. Glass chips pelted across his back and stung his cheek and the back of his neck. They sparkled like a diamond tiara in his hair.